Hi, and welcome to Swiss Info's program for December 27th. I'm Jeannie Wirtz. As a child growing up in the American Midwest, I didn't think there was anything particularly extraordinary about spending a rainy evening down in the basement if the weathermen announced we had progressed from a tornado watch to a tornado warning. In school, we had tornado drills, where we practiced sitting in the long hall with our backs against our lockers, heads on our knees, and fire drills, where we closed the doors to our classrooms and left the building, 500 students in single-file lines, no talking allowed. We did a lot of practicing, but as far as I know, my Chicago suburb was never actually hit by a tornado. Not everyone is so lucky. This week, Swiss Info talks with people who have lived through natural disasters and asks some experts what they're doing to manage risk.
At that time, I was on Kopratang. I was managing the Golden Buddha Beach Resort, and I was in the office. When I realized it's something going on, I was running with my son behind the mangrove. But before I reached the mangrove, I fell with my son. So everybody stopped, and then we could just hear the water coming against us. And one Thai guy, he just took my son and started running up the hill. And everybody started running up the hill.
Lori Folador, who was born in Zurich and grew up in Lugano, was living in Thailand when an undersea earthquake measuring 9.1 on the Richter scale hit off the island of Sumatra on December 26, 2004. The quake triggered waves up to 30 meters high, which came ashore in 14 countries around the Indian Ocean. Worst hit were Indonesia, Sri Lanka, India, and Thailand. Swiss Info reporter Luigi Iorio has many contacts in Thailand. I talked with him about the day the tsunami hit. Where were you when the tsunami hit?
Oh, I remember very well that day. It was a Sunday morning, and I was working at Swiss Info. I was following the news, and I immediately realized that something big happened.
Were you able to contact the people you knew in Thailand, and what did they tell you?
Of course, I tried to call some friends in Phuket, but I couldn't talk to them. I had emails only a few days later, and everybody was fine, but of course, everybody was shocked. They never saw or even imagined something like that.
225,000 people, including around 100 Swiss, died during the tsunami. For the 10th anniversary of the disaster in 2014, Luigi Iorio went back to the south of Thailand. What is it like now, 10 years later?
Well, last November I went to Phuket and Khao Lak, which were badly hit by the tsunami. And I was shocked to see how the places developed in the last 10 years. Huge resorts, restaurants, shops, markets. You know, they built everywhere, also near the beach, as the tsunami never happened.
One of the people Iorio talked to was Luca Bosconi.
Fortunately, I was not in my house because when the tsunami struck, I was on the way to Bangkok to meet my family, and I had just left my house and my boat anchored in front of my house. And when I came back about 3 days later, the house had disappeared completely and the boat was up in the rubber plantation.
The Swiss reacted to the disaster by donating 227 million Swiss francs, the largest amount of aid in Swiss history. The inflow of money from various sources set off a building boom. One of the places affected was Kopratang.
A few weeks after the tsunami, a lot of aid organizations arrived on the island with a lot of money to spend. They rebuilt villages and infrastructure. But the survivor didn't want to live on the island anymore, you know. I met some fishermen that they told me they're still afraid today, you know, of the tsunami. And, of course, other people, they lost their jobs, so they didn't have nothing to do on the island, so they just left to the mainland.
Not everyone is afraid. Luca Bosconi takes a pragmatic view.
I think that what happened was mainly due to non-awareness of the problem of the tsunami itself. I think if people had been advised a little bit better, let's say like it is now, you know that there is an earthquake and that there could be a tsunami, most of the people could have survived. And things like that seems to happen like every 200 or 300 years. So I don't at all feel in immediate danger. And, well, that is why I still have a boat on the beach, on the same beach, and a house just a little bit higher up on the hill, but still near the sea.
For Lori Folador, on the other hand, the world has changed.
Before the tsunami, I wasn't scared about the sea, the wave. I would jump in the wave. But now I don't trust the sea anymore. And if there is big wave, I would never go swimming because it can change in a minute.
Although I managed to live in Chicago for 17 years without ever actually seeing a tornado, it took only 1 year in California to experience a major earthquake. In October 1989, I was working in a small one-story office in a town south of San Francisco when the room began to shake. The people around me, all native Californians, started diving under tables. I bolted out the door into the parking lot. It was a strange sensation. The concrete beneath me was moving. It was like I was standing on a dock that was being rocked by a succession of waves. That night, it took more than an hour to make the 15-minute drive to my apartment. The cars drove bumper to bumper the entire way. At home, I found my roommate cleaning up the tropical fish that had sloshed out of our fish tank. I slept in my clothes by the door, ready to run at any time. 63 people died in California's Loma Prieta earthquake, which had a magnitude of 7.1. The Great East Japan earthquake of March 2011, on the other hand, had a magnitude of 9.0 and a death toll of almost 16,000. It created tsunami waves over 40 meters high that traveled up to 10 kilometers inland and caused a meltdown in the nuclear reactors in Fukushima. 15-year-old Aya was at school when the quake hit Tohoku at 2:46 p.m. She and her classmates were cleaning. It was spring. Swiss Info's Joe Fahey talked with Aya about her experience.
What did the earthquake feel like?
In the beginning, it started with a little shaking. Those little shakes came over and over again, so we thought it was just a little earthquake, maybe a 3 or so on the scale. And we said, oh, is that the earthquake again? While we were cleaning up. But it got stronger, and then we couldn't keep standing anymore, and it was really shaking, up and down and side to side.
Had your class ever practiced leaving the school in an emergency before?
Yes, we had. Once a month we practiced evacuating and pretended that a tsunami had come or that a big earthquake had happened.
And when it happened for real, did everything happen as you'd practiced or did people panic a lot?
Whenever we practiced evacuating, we were all saying, it's not really coming. And we didn't really believe that it would come. We didn't take it seriously. When the earthquake came, we were all in a panic. Everyone was running all over the place. And we realized how important practicing was. Thanks to the fact that we had practiced, we were able to evacuate. But it took twice as long as it should have.
The Great East Japan earthquake had repercussions not only for the people who lived through it, but also for other parts of the world. In Switzerland, for example, the nuclear meltdown led to a major change in the Swiss government's energy policy, with a decision that same month to phase out nuclear power. Another example of how closely the countries of the world are connected was the eruption of a volcano in Iceland in April 2010. It was spring vacation, and I was in London with my daughter. We had an afternoon flight back to Zurich. My telephone beeped. It was a text message from the airline. Our flight had been cancelled. And ours wasn't the only one. Costanza Bonadonna is a scientist based at the University of Geneva who studied the eruption of Eyjafjallajökull. During a break at an international workshop on living with geological risks, she talked with me about the importance of international cooperation.
You're doing research on volcanoes. Are you a volcanologist?
Yes, I am a volcanologist. My specialization is actually in volcanic ash.
Is it really an international effort now working on solving problems of volcanic eruptions?
Yes, of course. I mean, there are volcanoes all over the world. And as I showed, there are 9 particular centers, which are called the Volcanic Ash Advisory Centers. They have the responsibilities of 9 different sectors of the Earth. And basically it becomes really an international effort because obviously volcanoes don't know any boundaries. So when you have an eruption in one country, then, you know, you might have impact in other countries. So this is why we really have to come together to come out with optimized strategies for risk mitigation.
And what are the advantages of coming to a congress like this one? What do you get out of it then? I mean, obviously not everybody does volcanic research who's here, so...
Yeah, but this is a great workshop in terms of like risk reduction. So it's very important to, you know, to check notes and just kind of compare how kind of we do things in different fields. Because at the end of the day, in order to progress both in science and in the kind of field of risk reduction, we need to come up with multidisciplinary approaches. So this is why we cannot just kind of sit in our office as a kind of scientist and then the people that deal more with the mitigation, they just sit in their office. We have to come together to just talk to each other and come up with my strategy for risk reduction.
Whereas Costanza Bonadonna is working to spread scientific knowledge about disasters, Arno Vicky of the Swiss Agency for Development and Cooperation is involved in defining disaster-related government policy. How has Switzerland's approach to managing disasters changed?
In the old days, the approach was mainly event-driven. For instance, the authorities reacted when a big flood occurred in one of the Alpine valleys, removed the debris, rebuilt, and took specific measures that this specific event would not happen again. And today it's about managing risk. This means that we look at the potential destructive events and their root causes and try to prevent and avoid risk or have a clear understanding of what risk we are willing to accept.
So managing risk, you're doing this all over the world, not just in Switzerland.
We have to distinguish clearly between what the Swiss authorities are doing in Switzerland, and that's what I just described, and what we try to promote abroad, mainly in emerging and developing countries. And that's the role of the Swiss Development Corporation.
You also came in after the tsunami and rebuilt, I think.
Yes. SDC was very active in rebuilding tsunami-struck areas. That means rebuilding the houses, the schools, the hospitals of the communities and the people who lost everything. The effort then is to rebuild in a better way.
Vicky sees a need for political engagement to help support the shift away from responding to disasters and toward managing risk. At what level is political engagement needed?
I think at all levels. At a global level, it's about awareness building. It's about best practice, political engagement. Switzerland is, for example, very engaged in the negotiations of a new global framework on disaster risk reduction. Then at the national level, it is absolutely key for developing the right policies and incentives for better risk and disaster management. And at the local level, the awareness building and measures that are taken are hugely important, as a disaster is always a local event with local repercussions. Therefore, the political engagement at local level is absolutely key.
That's all we have time for. More news and features about Switzerland are available on our website, www.swissinfo.ch. Thanks for listening. Tune in again next week. I'm Jeannie Wirtz.